Bassan Oda is a Palestinian journalist, an activist, and a filmmaker. She is best known for her social media videos documenting her experiences during the Israel-Hamas war in the Gaza Strip. She won a 2024 Peabody Award in the news category and an Edward R. Murrow Award for news series with her Al Jazeera Media Network show, It's Bassan from Gaza and I'm Still Alive. The show also won a 2024 News and Documentary Emmy Award for Outstanding Hard News Feature Story, short form. So this is a poem by Bassan Oda. Each time Gazans somehow manage to survive and live again, one way or another, war after war. But this time is different. If Gaza is over this time, the world is inevitably over. The world developed its way of murdering. Its greediness grew, and its desecration of innocence has extended. If Gaza doesn't make it this time, this means that victory is for the most violent and the most barbaric.
À chaque fois, les Gazaouis ont réussi à survivre et à vivre à nouveau, d'une manière ou d'une autre, guerre après guerre. Mais cette fois, c'est différent. Si cette fois Gaza est exterminé, le monde est inévitablement terminé. Le monde a développé ses façons de tuer, sa cupidité a grandi et sa profanation d'innocence est étendue. Si Gaza ne s'en sortait pas cette fois-là, cela voudrait dire que la victoire irait au plus violent et au plus barbare.
And that was written by Bassan Oda. Next, we have some Al Jazeera coverage from November 19th, 2024. First about Gaza, and then covering the situation in Lebanon.
For the first time in a month, Israel has resumed attacks against Hezbollah targets within Beirut itself, just as the armed group was set to respond to a U.S.-drafted ceasefire proposal. It responded with a yes, but with reservations, particularly about a Western-led committee to oversee the deal.
Now, according to Parliament Speaker Birri, the actual American proposal itself does not include Israel freedom of maneuver. That's being said to be more media speculation. But the that issue of the committee to oversee the implementation of a resolution, that is a point of reservation.
Israel has still not stated its position on the U.S. proposal that is based on U.N. Resolution 1701. It was adopted in 2006 and called on Lebanon to extend its authority along the border. Israeli officials say it was never implemented, and its army crossed the border last month as part of efforts to destroy Hezbollah's capabilities.
Israeli residents in the north will only be able to return home if the army has freedom to face any breach by Hezbollah or any other terrorists.
That freedom of action is seen here as a violation of sovereignty.
These attacks in central Beirut are increasing a sense of insecurity among a population that's already struggling with a collapsed economy. Hezbollah has called on its supporters to be patient. They may listen.
But in areas outside the group's dominance, many people are angry. There are deep political and sectarian divisions in Lebanon.
Where are we heading to? This has to end. We don't want war. We want to live in peace. There is bombing every day. There should be a ceasefire.
Others disagree. They say Hezbollah members are part of society, and there is no justification for Israel to target them away from the battlefield.
I think every person has the right to defend his country, no matter what. And of course, probably they were visiting their relatives, their people they know, so they have the right to move all over Lebanon.
2 months into a war that has already killed thousands, there is cautious optimism that a proposal to end the conflict is on the table. But for now, that's all it is. Zana Khudr, Al Jazeera, Beirut.
This week in Gaza began as so many have, with more massacres of Palestinians. Dozens of people killed in an airstrike on Beit Lahia, more in Khan Yunis, Al-Mawasi, and so on. Scenes of mass murder and forced displacement that fail to make headlines on most Western news channels, and certainly not in the Israeli media.
There's very little from these scenes. 90 people were killed in Beit Lahia 10 days ago in a bombing. This was rarely reported, even not to mention being shown. But there is still a very forceful trend to depict the images of the bodies of children taken out from the rubble as fake news.
And every terror has his own shift.
Israel has an iron grip on the news cycle. Journalists who are allowed into Gaza are usually friendly and carefully managed, and information coming from official sources is often skewed or inaccurate. Forced displacement in northern Gaza. Israeli soldiers firing indiscriminately at civilians and aid workers, rarely being challenged. The war is being seen almost exclusively through official Israeli footage. Media handouts that flood the news landscape with the aim of projecting Israeli supremacy. The counterbalance is often user-generated content from Palestinians themselves, people with smartphones documenting the mass murder of their relatives, friends, and neighbors. Earlier this year, more than 50 international broadcast journalists, including senior staff members at CNN, the BBC, Sky News, Channel 4, ITN, ABC, CBS, and NBC, signed an open letter demanding foreign media be allowed into Gaza. The inability to report independently, the lack of transparency, the lack of access, points of frustration for the industry for months.
Our major problem covering Israel-Gaza right now is that we can't get there. This is an unprecedented situation. Independent Western journalists are not able to get there, or anybody else, except for those people who are absolutely risking their lives every single
day.
It's about telling the story of Gaza, telling the story of the Palestinians. You know, actual local journalists would tell you about a people.
In chat rooms and on social media, Israelis say they do see Palestinian suffering. Some credit those images for the mass protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his handling of the war. But even though there is some introspection about the treatment of Palestinians and the expansion of the war into Lebanon, Israeli propaganda that puts Hamas's attack on October the 7th center stage still dominates and fuels a sense of inevitability of Israel's ongoing decimation of the Arab communities around it. Israelis have started to describe the conflict as endless. The mission of their spin doctors, singular. Control the narrative, prolong the war. Zain Basravi, Al Jazeera.
Well, for more on this, let's bring in Orly Noy. She's an editor at Local Call. It's an independent Israeli media agency, and she joins us live from West Jerusalem. Thank you so much, Orly, for joining us. So we've heard that report there. What's your experience so far on what you're seeing or not even seeing when it comes to freedom of press or a lack of it?
Thank you so much for having me. I think that your introduction was actually way too kind towards the Israeli media. It's not about tight governmental control. The Israeli media has the freedom to report the truth and the facts from Gaza if it wanted to. The thing is that the Israeli media doesn't want to report the truth, doesn't want to report the facts, and is very much willingly is a complicit in concealing the truth about the heinous crimes that are being committed in Gaza. If you're an Israeli that got all your information about the war in the last year only from the Israeli media, you would come to think that for over a year, the Israeli army is fighting only terrorists in the Strip and doing everything within its capacity to protect civilians from being harmed. You would think that it's the most moral army in the world, providing more than enough humanitarian aid, alarming people before bombing their houses. That is considered to be something very humanitarian in the eyes of the Israeli public. So yeah, the Israeli public is just seeing a different war than the rest of the world is seeing.
Mm. And, you know, context is king when it comes to journalism. Certainly in my experience, having been in the field there, many of us were targeted from as soon as the war started, if they even assumed a person was working for Al Jazeera. Of course, many of our journalists have also been killed. And now we've also been banned from reporting there. Is that likely to change anytime soon?
I don't see it changing, and you should see, by the way, it's even worse than not reporting is the Israeli journalists that actually do enter Gaza, of course, on Israeli tanks and with Israeli military protection. We could see Inon Magal, one of the prominent Israeli journalists, actually filming himself as he himself bombs houses.
This is the social media guy, is that right? The anchor that has a huge following online.
Exactly. He was very proud about it, you know, celebrated his participation in the war and in the destruction. But, you know, Magal is a well-known rightist activist. He's not taken very seriously as a journalist. The more problematic appearance is with a journalist like Orat Chemo, very respected journalist that has been covering the Palestinian scene for years. His documentary from last week was a shameful display of propaganda when he entered once again, protected on an Israeli military jeep, a tank to the strip. And they promoted this piece very extensively, saying it's the first true footage from the strip that you could see. Of course, ignoring the dozens of Palestinian journalists risking their lives to report.
Well, speaking of dozens of journalists, you have around more than 126 Palestinian journalists that have been killed there since, and media workers as well, since the war started. Just because we're running a little bit out of time, Orly, we've also seen the highest number in a year since tracking started in 1992, not just of deaths of journalists, but also arrests. Now, the narrative that you're talking about, yes, it's top down, but how much is the public willing to even believe in the existence of the fact that there are Palestinians under occupation? Because I've spoken to many of them, and yes, they seem to repeat the narrative that the government is putting out there, but how much of the media there is complicit to that? Because they could, if they wanted to, push against that, but they don't seem to.
I think that the Israeli media's coverage of the war resonates very well with the ongoing Israeli desire for revenge. So the Israeli public doesn't really have any interest in trying to reveal the truth behind or to question even.
Because the information is out there on social media. They could have access to it.
The information is out there. We at Local Call in 972 have dozens of Palestinian journalists. We publish their reports from Gaza. The information is out there if they want to. But the Israeli media won't give the public that information, and the Israeli public doesn't require that information. And again, it just sees a different war.
Mm, so much to unpick here, Orly Noor. We also haven't had a chance to talk about the videos that have come out of those soldiers that are sharing their videos on TikTok and really showing that they are complicit to war crimes. Thank you once again for joining us there, Orly Noor, editor at Local Call, an independent Israeli media agency.
Navi Pillay was born in 1941. She's a South African jurist who served as the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights from 2008 to 2024. She also served as a judge of the International Criminal Court and president of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. So here is Navi Pillay.
Navi Pillay is one of the world's most respected legal minds. She grew up in South Africa during the apartheid era, experiencing the racism and exclusion of white minority rule. After becoming a lawyer in 1967, Pillay was the first woman of color to open a legal practice in her home province of KwaZulu-Natal. She became deeply involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, defending activists, exposing torture, and helping political prisoners like Nelson Mandela. In 1995, 1 year into democracy, Mandela made Pillay a high court judge. She was the first woman of color to serve in South Africa's highest court. In the same year, the UN General Assembly elected Pillay to be a judge on the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. During her 8 years there, she made significant contributions to broaden what legally qualifies as an act of genocide. Pillay later served as a judge in the International Criminal Court at The Hague, until she was appointed to lead the UN's High Commission for Human Rights in 2008. In her 2 terms as commissioner, she worked to expand the scope of the body's anti-discrimination work to include previously unaddressed groups, like migrants and people who face caste-based discrimination. Today, Pillay chairs the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, an independent body that investigates alleged abuses of international humanitarian law under Israeli occupation. On this episode of The Interview, I'll talk to Navi Pillay about her work and her lifelong journey fighting for human rights. And the chair of that independent commission of inquiry for the occupied Palestinian territory, Navi Pillay, joins us now on The Interview. Ma'am, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for inviting me to talk about this crucial affair.
It is a crucial affair, and it's interesting that the Commission of Inquiry, for somebody who doesn't know, they might think that this was set up after October the 7th. Just to lay the foundation a little bit, I'm curious to know the circumstances within which it was set up in 2021, and how things might have changed over the past year since October the 7th and the aftermath.
Well, first, we all know this is a 70-year struggle, so we always bear in mind the historical background and conflicts. There have been many conflicts, but this commission was set up on the 21st of May, 2021. It has a very wide territorial and jurisdictional mandate. It's there set up by the Human Rights Council to investigate in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. So we can investigate inside Israel as well, all alleged violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. And you're quite right, Imran, this was set up long before October 7th. When October 7th, 2022 happened, we stopped our planned work and investigated that incident as well.
Why has it been so controversial to many people when you say October the 7th, 2023 didn't happen in a vacuum and that there's a context to it? Why did you face so much backlash? Why do you think so?
Because the war now waged against Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territory and the spillover into Lebanon is all being justified because of the October 7th attack by Hamas and Palestinian armed groups. And therefore, we continually put in the historical background. I myself, as High Commissioner for Human Rights, supervise the hundreds of reports relating to the violations under occupation. So we have to see it in this context, not just October 7th and the retaliation thereafter.
For those who believe this is a genocide, I mean, even if people don't go to that extent and they're not so sure, it is clearly massacre upon massacre. And for many, they're seeing it happen in real time in front of the cameras in Gaza particularly.
How does this differ from other conflicts and other such situations of utter carnage, especially from a powerful military against innocent civilians? How does it differ for you, given your vast experience, given that this is happening in real time, and there's so much evidence that emerges right in front of us? Does it even help your team in collecting evidence?
It's very difficult to be investigating in the midst of conflict, number one, and secondly, without the cooperation of the host government. We've made like 20 or 25 requests to Israel, and they're just silent about letting us in to investigate. That is a challenge, but it has not put off the team, my brave team that is working on these matters day and night. It's helpful that so much of the atrocities are being filmed and videoed and put on social media by many people, including the Israeli Defense Force or Israeli security forces, I should say. It's terrible, obviously, for the victims, but it's useful for investigation that we have access to that material. Let me say the difference you asked about the difference, Imran, is that, you know, I've never come across a situation where a government is actually acting in defiance of international law. You must cooperate and work with the United Nations, not against the United Nations, and definitely not attacking the United Nations officials. So all this is very, very chilling for me.
And does it then call into question the efficacy of the UN? As somebody who's been in the system for a long, long time, especially when you were UN human rights chief, does it call into question whether the UN is fit for purpose? Not only because the Israelis can continue to do whatever they want to do, but also because of the protection from the United States and the ultimate power that lies in the veto power in the UN Security Council.
It's a very faulty system, but that's the best we have, the United Nations. It's very, very important that we support multilateralism. This was an institution created after World War II to ensure peace and security in the world. I feel positive, Imran, because of the massive support that our commission has received from member states. It's true there are strong opponents on behalf of Israel from the United States, the UK, and quite a few European states. But overall, our recommendation to the UN General Assembly in 2020, that was before the...
that was your first... What was that? 2022, yes. Your initial report, right? I know the U.S. State Department had sort of dismissed it. So there was an... Talk to me about that initial report, and then talk to me about your report a few months ago to the General Assembly. Talk to me about how would you characterize the reaction to those two reports?
Well, firstly, the establishment of the commission, the resolution establishing our commission, was opposed. I was very surprised. By the United States. I expect Israel to oppose it. They always have, but the United States and some European states. And I asked them the question, why wouldn't you support a referral to your own court, the International Court of Justice, for an opinion? The resolution establishing this commission was opposed on very spurious grounds, that it's permanent and doesn't have a date ending it. And I was able to point out to the representative of the United States in the Human Rights Council that actually there are two other commissions and inquiries that do not have an end date, but were supported by the US and these opposing states. So a great deal of double standards, I would say, and taking sides. And you should not be taking sides. Everyone should be on the side of compliance with international law, and especially international human rights law. However, these opponents did not win, and I feel comforted that almost 87 states voted to ask for the ICJ legal opinion, because we identified that the root cause of the conflict is that the occupation is unlawful.
just as a small opportunity to educate myself, what are those other two commissions of inquiry that don't have an end date?
The one was on Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, these are those triple I mechanisms that were set up, I think, on Iraq.
I see.
They don't have an end date. They were supported and funded to the maximum, whereas we are struggling for funds. And of course, coming from South Africa, where we experience so much sabotage in liberatory work in South Africa, I can see that withholding funding is one of the ways in which they intend to ensure that we do not function. So I'm very happy. So I feel positive, mainly because of the hardworking team of just about 14 or 15 people who investigate, under the direction of Christian Dirty and myself, the commissioners.
So you have this powerful Goliath trying to make things a little bit difficult for you, withholding funding, not giving you the best opportunity to fulfill your mandate. At the same time, and you've mentioned South Africa, and of course, as we know, you are a high court judge in South Africa. You were actively involved in the liberation struggle against apartheid. South Africa came in and decided to take this to the ICJ. As somebody who was an ICC judge, somebody who was an ICJ judge with a special tribunal for Rwanda, some people tend to downplay it, nothing will happen, nothing good can come of it, this is just posturing. And other people seem to think that this might actually get the war to end and that this is crucial. South Africa's intervention at the International Court of Justice, joined by others, is a massive step. Where do you land on this? Because you're the best person to ask.
Imran, it's a massive step. And we are the ones, the commission, who motivated it. We set out all the facts on the ground. We set out the law, set out that it's a 70-year-old conflict. Our mandate requires us to identify the root cause of the conflict. And therefore, I welcome not only the resolution requiring an ICJ opinion, which they've delivered, but the application by South Africa. I'm very proud of the South African lawyers who were able to get the provisional measures under the Genocide Convention. These are very, very serious. And these are steps that states should have taken a long time ago. I had nothing to do with it, but I'm very happy that South Africa had the courage to bring that application.
Do you believe that Israel is plausibly committing genocide?
Well, you know, I'm called the genocide judge. I delivered the world's first genocide judgment in the Rwanda tribunal. A lot of the law comes in, Imran. It's very tricky. You have to prove an intention to commit genocide. You don't establish it just by pointing to the large numbers of killings, death, and destruction. All that helps. But you have to establish the intention, which in the Rwanda genocide, we looked at statements made by the political leaders. And we looked at policy, a direct intention to destroy the Tutsi population. This is what South Africa has to establish. But it seems to me, and I agree with many, many people who see it this way, they're halfway there. Because they were able to convince the court to grant provisional measures under the Genocide Convention on the premises that there is plausible reasons to suspect that genocide is being committed. I see that as half winning.
So we have the catastrophic situation on the ground, ongoing slaughter of people. We have statements, quotes from the defense chief, national security chief, finance minister, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, and all of those, Netanyahu himself. So you say they're halfway there. Okay, in terms of, forget intention for a second, in terms of the actual destruction on the ground, when we look at crimes such as, or what can be termed war crimes and the like, is that abundantly clear to you that those are being committed? Or if crimes are being committed, which ones are clear to you? That are sort of not even up for debate, that have been committed, especially over the past year?
You know, we've set this out in our report. And so we said there's ample evidence to prove that war crimes are being committed, crimes against humanity, violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. And so these include crimes of extermination, intentionally directing attacks against civilians and civilian objects, murder or willful killing, using starvation as a method of war, forcible transfer, gender persecution, targeting Palestinian men and boys, sexual and gender-based violence amounting to torture, and cruel or inhuman treatment. So every one of these is backed by the evidence that we found.
And you have a UN, so you have a UN Commission of Inquiry listing that litany of abuses, yet we still can't get to a ceasefire. So I'm going back to that question. How is the UN fit for purpose when we still can't get the killing to stop? We can't even get a pause on it.
I'm very much with you as a civilian. But as I said, I'm not here to defend the United Nations. I serve here under the mantle of the law and international law. I, in my life experience, found that the law always triumphs. The law triumphs over force. So at some point, they have to get back to the law, even those wielding the veto in the United Nations. Let me recall to all our viewers that when it came to apartheid South Africa, the United States and UK, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, used the veto to stop sanctions against the apartheid government. Later, they were persuaded to change their veto. And that's what gives me hope, that eventually they will be convinced by pressure from other states and by their own population demanding that their governments respect international law. So there has to be a change in the way the veto is being politically used at the moment. I'm very much part of the reform movement, and even as High Commissioner for Human Rights called for reform of the Security Council and this veto system.
Are we in the midst of that persuasion happening right now of the United States and maybe some of the other European countries where their support, particularly for Netanyahu's government, might not be unequivocal anymore? Do you feel that that's happening?
I wish I could, like Palestinians who are at the receiving end of incredible loss of lives, damage, and so on. I can understand from their point of view. There doesn't look like any immediate change in the policies of powerful governments who are supplying the weapons to Israel to change course. I do believe that reports such as ours, which are United Nations investigations, verified factual accounts of what's happening, and which we deliver to the Human Rights Council in Geneva and to the UN General Assembly every year, will tip the balance to convince states to stand up even more strongly against the use of the veto when it comes to humanitarian critical situation. So we take the complaints to the Security Council and we say, you know, you can't possibly use a veto in this situation. We're getting there to push for that kind of reform. You know, I myself, we saw no hope under apartheid, 300 years of apartheid, but we never gave up. Yeah. Everybody was involved in some way. And that's the way we feel towards Palestinians. They also, with the 70-year-old struggle, we will continue to oppose the use of the veto. Yeah. When factual complaints of humanitarian violations are placed before these veto-wielding countries.
Yeah, for some living in the early 80s, they might have found it very hard to believe that someday Reagan and Thatcher might actually decide the tide is turning, we need to do something different. And that's a really good point, good historical point that you've made, gives us some sense of perspective. I want to ask you, you were shaped and molded as a judge. Some of your highest profile positions were as a judge. This work is a bit different. It's advocacy. It's advocacy and something different. You don't get to make that final judgment. Does it frustrate you then sometimes that you lay out the evidence, you lay out the story, but you don't have control on what happens after that?
Imran, you're quite right. You know, I was the first woman of color to be appointed a judge by President Nelson Mandela, and then he nominated me to the GA, and I became an international judge. And that's what I'm trained to do, to be independent, impartial, look at the facts. I will never let down the trust that he placed in me in being very fair. However, then I became High Commissioner for Human Rights, and that, you're quite right to point out, is advocacy, not judgmental. Every High Commissioner for Human Rights will tell you that it is frustrating because the main violators of human rights law are states themselves, yet they are the duty bearers to deliver and protect human rights. I get some of that when I sit here now as chair of this commission of inquiry. My mandate is to investigate fairly, bring facts to the ground in the name of the United Nations. We get the full support of the entire UN mechanism and all the agencies when we come up with these reports. So I should think there is a certain judicial element in the way we approach an analysis of the facts and verification of the facts. It is advocacy, but it's very important work. And therefore, I readily agreed to undertake this work.
I believe my judicial
training actually enhances this work and provides some respect for the commission's standing.
And your judicial training no doubt gave you a very thick skin. In passing judgment, you probably faced a lot of backlash sometimes from, I don't know, people who have been sentenced for those who have been condemned for crimes. The criticism, especially when it gets personal, does it hurt you? Does it affect you? I just did a Google search. There's an international law weekend coming up. You were invited by a law firm. 37 pro-Israel organizations put out a petition. They associate your name with being anti-Israel, with being anti-Semitic, and so on and so forth. When you come across that, does it sting? Does it hurt?
No, it does not, you know. I understand fully these are lobby groups. They are not disputing the content of our report, the facts that we have found. So they have to find some ways of saying it's all lies or to attack the commissioners personally. It doesn't affect me. I will continue with the work because I am satisfied that I am not anti-Semitic and I'm not doing this for awards anyway. But the incident you mentioned, the International Law Association, in fact, already gave me the award last year, despite the objections of certain lobby groups.
Okay. I ask this a lot of my guests in trying to find some hope amid genocide, carnage, desperation. Who are the good guys out there? Who are the peacemakers? Who are the role models to make the world a better place?
There are many of us. Apartheid didn't end in South Africa because one or two persons spoke up. We all did. So we all have a responsibility to speak up about any violations, violence. And in this particular case, Palestinians have been silenced. They're unable to take their voices themselves or to take action. I think the collective action by civil society across the globe is what's needed here.
Do you think the occupation will end in your lifetime?
I certainly do. I used to answer that question, do I think apartheid will end in my lifetime? Would you believe, Imran? I used to say, no, I don't see any hope of apartheid ending in my lifetime. Well, there you are. You know, I've lived now like 25 years after apartheid ended. We still have many problems, but we empathize so closely with the Palestinians because they were struggling for their liberation at the same time as South Africa. That is some of our background on respect for the rights of freedom for everyone. And this is why it's not a matter of picking or being hurt. It's being convinced that you occupy the high moral ground when you speak up against the oppression of people.
Navi Pillay, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the interview.
Thank you, Imran.
Take care.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Navi Pillay. And next, we're going to hear Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan, and she's going to talk about her experience with the children in Gaza.
You know, Sam, there are over 20,000 children in Gaza who are missing. These are reports by Save the Children and other very credible organizations. And do you know what I mean by missing? Can you imagine where they might be?
I can't.
Under the rubble, in mass graves, maimed beyond recognition so that nobody can identify them and know, you know, what the child's identity is. Some of them have been detained, children under the age of 18, under the age of 16, who've been detained by Israeli forces, who have disappeared. These are all, I mean, can you imagine?
Now we're going to hear a series of short internet commentary. We're going to hear from Surgeon Nissan Mahmoud about the bombing of tents and quadcopters to shoot at civilians. We will hear about the Zionist soccer fans in Amsterdam. And we have three comments by Francesca Albanese, who is the UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine. And finally, we'll hear George Galloway explain that Iran has a right to nuclear weapons. So I'm going to just present these one after another without further commentary. So here we have a description of a pregnant, injured woman at the hospital in Gaza.
There was a young woman who got laid up right next to the young boy I was treating. She was 22 or 23 years old, full body surface area burns, and she was unable to speak. And a woman screamed from outside the door, "Hamil, she's pregnant." And so we turned her over quickly because she had come and lay down on her belly, and somebody put an ultrasound probe on her belly, and she had a viable 18 to 20 week pregnancy. But when we did our secondary survey and tried to understand what other injuries she had a shattered tib fib from an explosive injury. She had burns that covered over 70% of her surface area, which is a death sentence in an environment where you can't find gauze and there isn't clean water and there aren't antibiotics. We all knew what this meant on the ground in the trauma bay the first minutes we met her. She was gonna die there and her baby would die there. And there was nothing we were going to be able to do about it because the Israeli government and the IDF had made it impossible to care for people to the extent which they deserve. Every human being deserves the right to medical aid in that situation. She was no fighter. She was a pregnant woman who was sitting in her home when a bomb dropped on her head. And she eventually moved to the ICU. And every day she lived until she died, she was in pain. Because we didn't have the kind of medicine we needed to care for her pain. And every morning when we'd round, we'd...
And next, we have some commentary by Surgeon Nizam Mahmoud.
What I think I found particularly disturbing was that a bomb would drop, maybe on a crowded, tented area, and then the drones would come down and...
Please take your time. We're incredibly grateful that you're making the time to be here today. And I can only imagine just how it has impacted you and will continue to impact you. And I feel, because you can't unsee what you've seen, but being able to share that with us really helps us hold legislators particularly to account. So we do appreciate the time that you're making for us today. Thank you.
So the drones would come down and pick off civilians, children. And we had description after description. This is not, you know, an occasional thing. This was day after day after day, operating on children who would say, I was lying on the ground after a bomb had dropped and this quadcopter came down and hovered over me and shot me. And that's clearly a deliberate act, and it was a persistent act, persistent targeting of civilians day after day. We had one or two mass casualty incidents every day.
So 2 days ago, Zionist hooligans from the Tel Aviv football club, they came to Amsterdam because they had a match against Ajax. As we predicted, they were very violent. They roamed the streets with around 200 people at the same time. They would take down Palestine flags everywhere which they would see them. And we have footage of them singing a song that there are no schools in Gaza anymore because they burned all the children. Simultaneously, they also attacked a cab driver who spoke out against them. We all knew that this was going to happen because the football club already stated before the match, before coming here, that they were going to bring Israeli secret service, the Mossad. So we knew that they were going to be violent. And we also knew that amongst them supporters, a lot of them are IDF soldiers who have on their Facebook footage of being enlisted in the same army that's committing genocide. The moment they harassed one of the taxi drivers, they got a response. Thing is, the taxi drivers here, as I think all over the world, are quite well connected with each other. So within no time, over 100 taxi drivers came to the city center and chased the hooligans away. Chased them towards the casino, or some of them would jump in the canals. What do you expect if you come to our streets and sing about burning Gaza down? In Amsterdam, a Zionist hooligan can fuck up our streets, can burn down Palestine flags, can sing songs about burning Gaza down. But the moment you respond to them, the riot police emerged. They arrested over 50 protesters. And as according to the Zionist playbook, of course, this morning, Netanyahu sent out a statement, called the prime minister. He said that he sent out airplanes to pick up the hooligans because it was too dangerous for them. But yeah, instead of fact-checking Israel, of course, our media just follows them. And all of a sudden, all over the news, it was about how the hooligans were harassed by protesters, how it was about religion as well. It was never about religion. There was a clash with them because they're part of a genocide. According to the Zionist playbook, of course, you only focus on the counter response instead of the context in which it happened. So the media followed the complete narrative of Netanyahu that it was anti-Semitic. Secondly, most of our politicians just followed Netanyahu on this, making statements that anti-Semitism is not allowed, completely omitting the fact that the night before, Zionist hooligans fucked up our city, attacked people, completely omitting that fact. And as somebody from Amsterdam, let it be known that even though our authorities, our media, and our politicians follow the Zionist playbook, eat the sandwich of shit that Netanyahu is feeding them, the people stand with Palestine.
Possible that after 42,000 people killed, you cannot empathize with the Palestinians. You, those of you who have not uttered a word about what is happening in Gaza, demonstrate that empathy has evaporated from this room. And empathy is the glue that makes us stand united as humanity. But don't worry, I mean, you can continue and you will become more and more irrelevant to the rest of the world, which is in turmoil. And it's not just the global south. Look at the young people in Europe, in Western countries, those to whom many of you, including my own country and Germany and France and the UK, are demonstrating that human rights are good to be taught in schools and universities. But don't dare you trying to exercise freedom of assembly and freedom of expressions in your street, all the more for Palestine. This is what you are telling young generation. No one has been spared, not just among the Palestinians and the Lebanese, even in the United Nations. And it's because of that, on top of the genocide and on top of the 57 years of unlawful occupation, that I say it's time to consider suspending the credential of Israel as a member state. And I understand the sensitivity, because none of you has really clean hands when it comes to human rights. That's okay. But no one else has maintained an unlawful occupation violating decades of UN Security Council, General Assembly, Human Rights Council, International Court of Justice, decision and resolutions as Israel has done. Enough. Enough.
Francesca Albanese alleges Palestinian doctor likely raped to death in Israeli detention. Palestinian doctor Adnan Al-Bursh died in an Israeli prison after over 4 months of detention at both the Stiman facility and Ofer prison. UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories Francesca Albanese alleged that Palestinian doctor Adnan Al-Bursh was sexually abused until his death while in Israeli detention, according to a post to her X/Twitter account on Monday. Albanese wrote, "A doctor. A stellar surgeon. The embodiment of Palestinian ethics. Likely raped to death. The racism of Western media who are not covering this, and Western politicians who are not denouncing this, together with 1,000 other testimonies and allegations of rape and other forms of mistreatment and torture that Palestinians have suffered in Israeli jails, is absolutely sickening," Albanese said. Senior Palestinian doctor Adnan Al-Bursh died in an Israeli prison after over 4 months of detention at both the Stiman facility and Ofer prison, Reuters reported in May. Reuters stated that Al-Bursh, head of orthopedics at Al-Shifa Hospital, was detained by the IDF while temporarily working at Al-Awada Hospital in northern Gaza. The IDF began operations in the Al-Shifa Hospital in mid-November 2023 after the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war, with Israel stating that there was a Hamas command center beneath the hospital. Following the beginning of the operations, Al-Bursh fled Al-Shifa to the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, Sky News reported. The IDF began operating at the Indonesian hospital, leading Al-Bursh to move to the Al-Awada Hospital, a smaller hospital also located in northern Gaza. The military soon began operations at Al-Awada, and the IDF told medical staff and patients to evacuate due to the operations, and where Al-Bursh was detained. Al-Bursh detained at Stiman, Ofer prison. The IDF reportedly confirmed to Sky News that Al-Bursh was detained by the military and was taken to the Israeli military base Stiman. Sky News cited other Palestinian prisoners on the abuse at Stiman. In April, Al-Bursh was moved to Ofer prison under the Israel Prison Services. The Sky News report cited people who claimed to have witnessed the moments prior to Al-Bursh's death, who said that he, Al-Bursh, had clearly been assaulted with injuries around his body. He was naked in the lower part of his body. Al-Bursh was then left in the yard and was helped to the rooms by other prisoners, and died shortly after. The Israel Prison Services, IPS, told Sky News that they were not aware of the claims.
And that was the computerized voice reading the words of Francesca Albanese. Francesca Albanese is the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. And next we're going to hear from George Galloway. He's expressing his opinion that Iran has a right to have nuclear weapons. So here's George Galloway.
We can't have a world where some people are allowed to have nuclear weapons and threaten others with them, while the potential victim of those nuclear weapons does not have the right to nuclear weapons. Now, I've said on this program before, of course, I don't speak for Iran. The Iranians might not like me saying so. But if I was the leader of Iran, I'd already have a nuclear weapon. Because the United States, Britain, France, the enemies of Iran, all have nuclear weapons. And Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons, never declared, secretly held, illegally built, never inspected by the IAEA or any international agency. Why should Israel be allowed to have nuclear weapons pointed at Iran? But Iran is not allowed to have nuclear weapons to defend itself. Wasn't that the whole thesis of those who believe in nuclear weapons? That they are mutually assured destruction, that they keep the peace? That's the talking points of the NATO talking heads. Well, if that was true for the NATO and Warsaw Pact standoff, presumably it's also true between Israel and Iran.
If you're not crying when you think about Palestine, you don't really know a thing about Palestine. When you're trapped between the bullets and the borderline, where you gonna run to when the bombs start falling? Well, now he's searching for his father in the rubble, but he's crying so he's seeing double. He's clinging to his brother's hands. His mother used to tell him, just stay out of trouble, Ali, listen to your brother. But now his mother's gone, and there's no place to run, and there's no place to hide from the open sky. And when you're dumb, what will this child become? When you're raining fire into his open mind, raining fire into the open. If you're not crying when you think about Palestine, you don't really know a thing about Palestine. When you're trapped between the bullets and the borderline, where you gonna run to when the bombs start falling? You're not crying when you think about Palestine, you don't really know a thing about Palestine. When you're trapped between the bullets and the borderline, where you gonna run to when the bombs start falling? Well, now they're talking about the numbers on the telly, 20,000, 30, they don't know how many. Some of these families got no one even left to bury. Every generation been taken like this is ordinary. And still you're telling me there are no innocents, while you be bombing all the children in their tenements. And while these crooked politicians keep arguing over who the threat is, I hear these dead kids singing, we are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. While our leaders wring their bloody hands and say they can't give in to our demands, they keep on signing the papers and doing the favors to keep the weapons flowing to the Holy Land. So tell your leaders that you've had enough, keep on fighting, never giving up. Try to give your voice to the voiceless. There's power in your choices, singing at the top of your voices. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. We are not numbers, no, no. We are not numbers, no, 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 no. If you're not crying when you think about Palestine, you don't really know a thing about Palestine. When you're trapped between the bullets and the borderline, where you gonna run to when the bombs start falling? Thank you. Please keep using your voice to speak up for the people in Palestine. Thank you.